Welcome to Podcast One. We hope you'll support our sponsors who bring you these podcasts absolutely free and with limited interruptions. And of course, we appreciate you listening to this show, which will get started in just a second. The following program is brought to you by your friends at Podcast One.
He's an American icon who fought in World War II, gave you Martin and Lewis, Martha Ray, George Gobel, Tennessee Ernie Ford, Andy Williams, Fried Green Tomatoes, Spinal Tap, The Princess Bride, The Sure Thing, Stand By Me, The Declaration of Independence, People for the American Way, and a few TV shows.
Maybe you've heard of a couple of these.
All in the Family, Sanford and Son, Maude, Good Times, The Jeffersons, Hot L, Baltimore, One Day at a Time, Mary Harmon, Mary Harmon, The Dumplings, All's Fair, All the Glitters, Fernwood Tonight, America Tonight, Different Strokes, The Facts of Life, The Baxters, Archie Bunker's Place, Silver Spoons, Gloria, Square Pegs, a.k.a. Pablo, Who's the Boss, 227, Sunday Dinner, The Powers That Be, 704, Hauser, Channel Umpteen and 3, One Day at a Time on Netflix.
All of the above with Norman Lear. It's all of the above with Norman Lear. What you do, you know that Norman Lear is just another version of you.
So, this is Norman Lear. The title of this podcast is All of the Above with Norman Lear. And I don't know how I prove to you that this is Norman Lear. I'm raising my right hand now and swearing to God. If you believe in God, if you don't believe in God, I'm still swearing to him, her. Usually I have a sidekick here who is named, what's his name again? Paul Hipp, who is a delightful actor and a songwriter and singer and guitar player and so forth. He's not here. He's in Memphis. And the guy across the table who is here and is my guest is one of the delights of my life. My friendship with him, which is not long and deep and so forth, but wishes to be, is Judd Apatow, who has made a number of films all of you have enjoyed, and television, and we can talk about all of that. But I want to say of him, he also, I don't know that he calls himself a comedian. He thinks himself, I think, a writer, director, producer, etc. But this is one funny son of a bitch. And I go to the Largo as often as I can possibly go. It's a nightclub here. It's a club here in L.A. And he does these wonderful shows for various causes and charities and so forth. He never does it for himself. People pay to come in. The money goes to the cause he's interested in. And they're checking his microphone as if he was talking, but he isn't. I've been occupying all of this space and time and so forth. But I'm looking at him now, and it's my great pleasure to say hello, Judd Apatow.
It's good to be here.
That's it. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.
I peaked 2 hours ago.
you woke up with what on your mind today?
Wow, that's a good question. What did I wake up with on my mind today? Well, I'm at the end of multiple projects.
Yes.
So I am finishing up a documentary about Gary Shandling, which will be on HBO in March.
You worked with Gary Shandling. You wrote on that show.
I did. I worked
Larry there. Sanders.
The first time I ever directed, I directed at the Larry Sanders Show. And so I'm finishing that up while also finishing my Netflix stand-up special, which will be on December 12th, which is scary because I have to look at myself and not hate myself, which is difficult. And then we have a new season of Crashing on HBO and Love on Netflix. And I made a documentary about the Avett Brothers, which is going to be on HBO in January. So everything I've done for the last couple of years is about to be sent out into the world in the next few months, and then I have nothing to do.
There's nothing with all of that on your calendar right now. Don't tell me there aren't things in development and ideas and so forth. And people out there who are constantly thinking about this will be, hopefully, prayerfully, this will be judged next.
Well, I'm in that moment where I have to write something. It's about time for me to direct a movie. And it's hard to think of a movie to direct with how weird the world is right now.
Wouldn't it be crazy and wonderful if I said to you, why don't we do this next thing together? And you said, but what do we do? And I said, how about this? Or I said, what do we do, after you said, what a good idea. And you said, how about this? And then on this podcast...
It happened.
It happened, and we elected to go ahead and do it.
I love it. I'll start. Ready? Well, let's just bang it back and forth, see if we can think of it. Something with marionettes.
Something with marionettes?
Don't you feel like the world is so crazy right now that in order to even talk about anything, you have to take it outside of reality? You have to get weirder or smaller, because have you ever had a time in your life where you felt this feeling of how strange it all is?
Yes.
Like was it like this in the late 60s and the early 70s? Or worse?
Not like this. I mean, you know, when – I'm not making this comparison for political reasons, but for – the sense and the drama of the moment or so forth. But I was a very young guy when a Hitler came along, and he was a clownish figure.
Yes.
Way over there before he became a terror. Holy, how did he get to be who he is? And at the same time, there was an Il Duce, Mussolini, in Italy. And in the Fox movie Joe News of a Saturday, they were clownish.
Yes.
I'm talking about before we learned how serious and seriously disturbed they were. Well, I think of the clownish situation we're in now that way.
Is that dangerous that the clown sometimes...
Well, it's dangerous because that clown has access to a button, we understand. And in the world, there is another clown in North Korea who also has access to the same terrorizing button.
Yes. And the clowns don't like to lose.
And they don't know what winning and losing is anyway. Everything is.
Yes.
I mean, to think about that is to... I guess what I'm the way I'm answering your question is, yeah, I've been... We were all through this at that time.
Yeah. I guess you think it's crazy when you're on a bomber. Like, that must have felt much crazier than right now when you're checking to see if the bombs fell out of the plane. You've been to the next place.
Well, I've been to that place. Oh, God, this got very serious so fast.
It did, because it is all serious. That's what I mean, is it's hard to be silly. I almost feel like I need to write something that took place in 1971 to take myself out of this anxiety we all feel. You know, we wake up in the morning and we check our Twitters to see what crazy thing happened in the few hours that the East Coast has been awake before us. And they always have something crazy. I never wake up, check the Twitter to see if anything happened, and nothing happened. Something always happened. And for some reason, Trump works on the weekends. So you don't even get the Sunday or the Saturday off.
Yeah, well, you said earlier you get up Sunday morning and watch CBS Sunday.
I do. I watch CBS Sunday morning all the time.
All the time.
It brings me great joy.
No, this was said before there was a camera around or before we were on the podcast or before we were talking. And
should we say that CBS Sunday Morning is taping us right now? And yeah. I'm hoping there's a piece on this episode about a giant ball of string or giant bale of hay. You know, I always like that when they would visit somebody who had a giant tinfoil ball.
Yeah. And while CBS is saying something or showing something, they might as well talk about that film I saw the other night.
What was that?
That you produced.
The Big Sick.
The Big Sick.
Yes.
Oh, what a great film. I had seen it sometime before. And looked at it again.
Oh, thank you.
I wanted to be sure I was looking at it was a film I had seen. Couldn't stop seeing it. So
I opened
the second time.
I'm glad you did that, because I've seen every All the Family 200 times. So you need to watch that movie 200
How
times.
How about One Day at a Time, which is on now?
I watch it all. Although I have to say, I still have, you know, as a young man who grew up in that era... You know, I had the Valerie Bertinelli crush, and my parents got divorced, so the single parent situation when I was young. I was watching it on TV.
How old were you when the parents got divorced?
I was 14. So yes. I was a young Valerie Bertinelli in my own way.
That. Now, was that divorce preceded by a lot of stuff that led to it that was in your presence?
Well, back then, when people used to get divorced, they didn't hide anything from the kids. They would just scream and go nuts in front of their kids.
Yeah, let's talk about that because I heard a lot of that too. My folks didn't get divorced. But every day of my life, I thought, why don't they?
Please do it now. Yeah, they didn't hide it from the kids. I mean, there was a lot of yelling, and your parents would tell you all their awful thoughts about each other to you as a child. And I remember my mom would be like, your dad is the devil. And I would think, well, I'm the devil's son. I must be at least half a devil. And that's how you become a comedian. It just messes you up in some way when your parents vilify each other. But it makes you a funny comedian. I mean, the worse it is, the funnier you get.
My folks didn't talk about the other one to us. We just heard them carry on.
Through the wall.
Huh?
Through the wall, you'd hear them?
No, I used to sit at a kitchen table, a small apartment. I used to sit at a kitchen table. Actually, this scene is in a film I made called Divorce American Style with Debbie Reynolds and Dick Van Dyke. And there, I used to sit at a kitchen table with a tablet and a pencil. And I would be clocking or marking who was winning.
The fight?
Yeah. I
said, play by play?
My dad, click. Yes. I mean,
you were Scully of their divorce.
Yes. And Dick Van Dyke in the film and Debbie Reynolds were having this big argument after a dinner party, after everybody kissed each other and hugged each other and left. And then they went at it. And the camera panned up to a transom and then into the bedroom, and I'm sitting in bed, or the character is sitting in bed doing the same thing.
That's so funny. Because when I was a kid, I wrote a poem about my parents' divorce, and I found it recently.
Yes, you remember.
And I read it on my stand-up special. And the poem was about how bad the divorce was, but how I felt like it would make me funnier and hopefully I could become a comedian one day. And I wrote it when I was 14.
Really?
Isn't that strange?
But it's historic. I mean, that's your...
I knew there was material in there, just like you. I was taking notes. What is it about us that when terrible things were happening, there was a part of our minds that were like, we got to write this down? Because no one told me to write it down. I just had this sense like, this is good stuff. I'm glad something's happening in this house.
Yeah. Did they find, when you were born, a pencil in your hand?
Did they find one in my hand?
Yeah, there might have been a pencil there.
Well, you were an owner for a very long time of record labels and jazz record labels. And my grandfather was this guy, Bobby Shad, and he was the head of A&R for Mercury Records.
I remember that name.
And he did Dinah Washington with Quincy Jones and Sarah Vaughan, and he produced the first Janis Joplin record. So my family, their whole fortunes were based on this one label, Mainstream Records, which still puts stuff out, like reissues. And that was a big part of my life, was jazz. Were you a giant jazz lover?
I have always been a giant, well, a jazz lover, but I'm not I'm not one of these people who knows a lot about it.
Yes.
You know what I mean? I love it. I could go anywhere and listen to it forever. Do I understand it?
Yes.
I feel I understand it, but I can't discuss all the jazz heroes in my life. At Concord, I was on the board of Village Roadshow Pictures, which bought Concord Records. So it was the closest I came to being a part of moving things around, of producing music at Concord, was my friendships with the guys, Glenn Barros and John. These were these were the guys who put everything together. I was just sitting on the board, but I loved every moment of that association.
Now, you've probably seen the best concerts of all time, like through all your decades. What's your top three or four greatest musical shows that you've witnessed?
I'm going to answer that and I, as I answer it, it suggests how I've lived all my life. The best jazz concert of my entire life, I expect to see when I go see, what's his face? This is 95, forgetting this.
Yes.
He just opened on Broadway. The great Springsteen.
Springsteen. That's what you think is going to be the best show.
Yes. I'm looking forward to next.
That's your next.
You know, I like the notion of over and next, two major words that we don't pay enough attention to. If something's over, it's fucking over. We're on to next.
And so, I have my tickets to see Springsteen in December.
Yes.
I'm very excited.
I have them. It may be December, but we have the tickets.
So you refuse to tell me your favorite concerts?
Well, it might have been Springsteen at the stadium here.
So you're a big Springsteen fan?
I'm a big Springsteen fan.
No, you must have seen Sinatra many times.
Yes, I've seen Sinatra many times. I made a film with him.
Which one?
Also, Come Blow Your Horn with Frank Sinatra and Tony Bill.
And he was a friend of yours.
We became friendly. I'm going to tell you a Sinatra story, if I may.
I'd like to hear
Ladies
it.
Ladies and gentlemen, may I tell him a Sinatra story? We were waiting for your phone calls. Here they are.
You're deciding not to tell the one you're thinking
of. No.
Because the good one is the one you're not going to say.
How did you guess that? Had the screenplay, Come Blow Your Horn, wanted him to read it. His son ran Paramount for...
Koch?
Koch.
Yes.
Howard Koch was producing him. And Howard helped me. Couldn't get Frank to read it. Now, I did these things to get him to read it. The first title was called... Cock-a-doodle-doo, waking up in the morning. This was about a kid waking up, his younger brother waking up to life. So it was called Cock-a-doodle-doo. I had 24 chickens or turkeys or whatever at his gate one day when he left.
200?
No, 20.
Oh, 20.
Two dozen. Okay. Never heard from him. I turned up at these crazy places. He used to call me, as a result of my no hair and so forth, the skull or something like that. I remember he was working with Judy Garland on a stage rehearsing. I came into a theater, big space, and he sees the skull. Get the skull the hell out of here or something. So one day, we were at Paramount so we could do this, Bud Yorkin and I. We had a big van pull up. The van was a Paramount van. And we filled it with what we thought of as the corner of a room, a reading corner. So there was a rug. There was an easy chair with an ottoman. There was a hanger with a smoking jacket. There was a pipe and some ashtray. I mean, it was a reading kit. And the note talked about the reading kit. The instruction was, we knew Sinatra was out of town. He was coming home that evening, to set it all out on the lawn and make sure the wire was long enough to find an outlet so that the lights would be on and so forth. And the rug and the ottoman, the whole thing was out there. Evidently what happened, well, anyway, the next day, never heard a word. Called his agent, whose name is Lenny, there was only one Lenny at William Morris, and...
Jewish guy.
A Jewish guy, yeah, Lenny.
Yeah.
And and said, tell Sinatra the hell with it, I'm never going to try to get it. I mean, if he could miss this and not care about this. And I told him what we did. And he said, there's no way he knows about that. No way he wouldn't react to that. And then we learned that some help had come home back to the house earlier than Frank so they make sure everything was tidy for him and, you know, be there to open the door and so on. And they put everything away. They rolled up the rug and put it away. He found a smoking jacket he didn't know he owned and didn't know. That was the only thing, and he had no reason to call. That's my Frank Sinatra story.
And then he said yes. He did read it.
He did read it, and we did it. Tony Bill, it was his first picture.
He must have really not liked reading. He was a guy who only liked to do like one or two takes, right?
Yeah. Oh, that was another prank. He did a take. I was happened to be on the set. Bud was directing. And I said, you know, it's something. I can't remember what it was. But maybe we should do that again. He said, no way, pal. I said, but I think whatever the hell bothered me. No way. I said, okay. And I'll see the dailies tomorrow morning, and if we have to do it, I'll let you know. He says, no fucking way.
Now, is that laziness, or what is his reason?
No, I remember him saying, my mom in New Jersey will not know that. Because a sound man said, I think I heard a plane or something. And he said, yeah. Screw it. No, I never thought of it as laziness.
His mom in New Jersey died on a plane.
She did?
That's how his mom died.
Oh, I don't.
Flying to go see him.
Is that right? I don't remember that.
Your jokes are more ironic than you know.
Anyway, I called him the next morning after I saw it. I thought, really, it has to be done again. And he was sitting in a makeup chair. He didn't start till 11:30, 12 o'clock or something. Sitting in a makeup chair. Frank, I just looked at the dailies, and we have to do that scene again. He said, I told you, no way. And I said, but we have to, or however I put it. And he said, you give me one fucking reason why. And I said, because I said so. At which point, I almost had a heart attack. I was so frightened that I yelled at him.
After he yelled at you.
And he said, okay. And then, that's simply.
And that was a lesson. Yell at Frank. Always yell hard at Frank.
It's you know, if you feel something is right, stay with it. Yeah. Stay with it. Stay with it.
Now, guys like that.
But I want to make, I don't want to sound brave here. I mean, I did that. I thought it was terribly funny to have yelled at him. And that's why I did it. I didn't do it to cause him to tell me. You know,
you did a comedic yell.
Yes, I was not brave. I was.
You were the guy that he had been yelling at for 2 solid months. You feel more comfortable having people think that Frank humiliated you for several months and you stood up for yourself.
No, but he didn't do things in a way to humiliate.
Yeah, he just like a brusque guy, or like looking back, we don't have to be that respectful of Frank. Was he a great guy or an asshole?
I thought of him as a great guy. Yeah. I don't remember people thinking of him as an asshole, as difficult, as totally opinionated. But I don't remember anybody thinking he was somebody you didn't want to be with.
Because there are people who are really hard to work with. They're confident, but generally their instincts are correct. And you put up with the pain in the ass aspect of their personality because they really deliver. And generally their point of view is pretty on. And was that what he was like?
Well, that's in everything that led up to my saying, because I said so, that's exactly the way I felt about him. This was one time when I thought he was dead wrong. And it wasn't a major thing, you know, it was something that could be done in 10 minutes. But the worst thing I can say about that moment and him is obstinate. Just obstinate. Now,
Kumail Nanjiani, not
Judd
obstinate.
Apatow.
My guys aren't obstinate.
Cut to Judd Apatow.
Yes.
As he, in his, when he's doing stand-up, as he talks about his kids.
Yes. I do talk about my kids quite a bit.
Yes. And I love the way. Yes. And so do hundreds of people in every audience.
I like that my daughter is not, is only a year or two younger than yours.
My twins are 22.
Yes, my daughter is turning 20.
Yes.
So I could still start having more kids. In 27 years, I could start having kids again.
In 27 more years,
you yeah.
could start having kids again?
How old were you when you had your last children?
66.
Okay, so in 16 years, I could do it again.
Yeah. Well, I think I want to suggest you do that.
I'm not against that. I think that's the new way. It seems to have worked out perfectly for you.
Well, it couldn't be more perfect.
It must keep your blood flowing because it's hard. Girls, I can imagine twins, they're very challenging. They're very dramatic. They challenge you. They feel everything. When I was a kid, I had no feelings. I would go in my room and watch Merv Griffin shut the door. I didn't talk to my parents about what was happening.
Well, no feelings behind that?
There were, but I knew to push them down as yeah. deep as I could and put some Haagen-Dazs over them. But you know, now I'm sure with your daughters, they tell you everything. If they're happy, they tell you. If they're miserable, they tell you. How did you handle the 15, 16-year-old years?
Yeah, what they didn't tell me was the why. Yes. They let me know they were miserable.
Yes.
And they let me know they didn't want me involved.
Yes.
They didn't. But I don't remember the long conversations of Dad. This is what's troubling.
They didn't spill. They just said, leave me alone. I'm having a bad day.
Did you have spillage?
I get all the details. Although, you know, right now we live with my 15-year-old daughter. My older daughter is at college, and my 15-year-old said to us that, you know, she doesn't like hanging out with us, which I understand, because four people is a family, three is a child observing a weird couple. That's what her life is. So if I say, you want to have dinner with us? She's like, why? Why would I want to have dinner with you? I don't care at all about your life, and you're just going to be controlling and weird with me. So that's the worst dinner ever. I mean, that's basically what the debate we have in the house. Trying to keep the kids out of trouble.
So you want to know something terribly
yes.
funny? I wanted to remember... I wanted to remember some of the films that I may not
yes.
have seen that Judd Apatow was involved. Do you know this guy has made a ton of films? Name 30 of them, won't you?
You want me to name some of them?
Some of them, yeah.
Knocked Up, This Is 40, Funny People, Trainwreck, 40-Year-Old Virgin, Pineapple Express, Superbad, The Cable Guy, Heavyweights, if you like kids' movies. Yeah, I have been involved in a lot of movies. I think
a lot of movies.
I think, you know, don't you realize that there's like a moment in your life where you realize you've done enough to fill a good reel when you get an award. You're like, I think I got enough movies. Like, you can make a pretty good reel out of this if you want to give me an award. And then that's when you should retire, when the reel, you know, you're not scraping together for the reel. Like, you don't even have room for everything. But I don't know if that's healthy or workaholism. Like, how did you ever figure out what was too much work? Because you had a lot of TV shows. I have two. I used to have three, and that was nuts.
But I'm sure this, if when I explain that, you feel the same way about what's going on with you, because you're doing so much. Anybody that's making an occasional film now knows Judd Apatow is doing, you know, three occasional films while they're doing one, and the television and so forth. I couldn't come in and do it, you know, when five shows were on the air and so forth. Mm-hmm. I couldn't come in and take over and run it if I had not grown up in the climate, in the atmosphere and so forth.
Yeah.
There was a show and became another show, and then somebody had another idea, or I had another idea.
You're like, there's a housekeeper, I'll give her her own show. That's the sister, she gets her own show. Everybody, and I've copied that. Like, I always think, oh, I want to see the spinoffs. You know, we did a movie for Getting Sarah Marshall, and Russell Brand was really funny in it, and so we did Get Him to the Greek with him and Jonah, and I like the spinoffs. Even This Is 40 is a spinoff of Knocked Up.
Well, I always think of what they call spinoffs. I always think about, you got somebody in the Bush League.
Yes.
And they're ready for the major.
That's right.
Russell Brand, you said, my God, he's funny.
Yeah.
Let's think of something he can do alone.
But you didn't do the Meathead show. But someone must have said, what are you going to spin off Meathead?
No, didn't do the Meathead show because soon after it was off the air, he came to me with the Spinal Tap.
Oh, he was directing.
Three, four pages of Spinal Tap and wanted to, you know, and we produced it. Our company produced it.
See how I've copied you? Because I've encouraged the people who work for me to direct. So Seth Rogen directs. James Franco has this new movie, The Disaster Artist, which is great. And I always told the actors and actresses, you got to write, you got to direct. And people did that in your world as well. But was there ever a moment when people said to you or your family, like, why do you need 5 shows? Why not 2? I get it. You know, there's always that debate. Yeah. Like, why do so much? Is it just because we can't say no? Or is it do you think it's healthy or crazy? Like, when you look back, do you go, I was nuts. Why didn't I just stick with a couple?
I don't know. Maybe it's like overeating.
Yes, yes. You know, that's right.
You've had enough, but here comes another dish you just got to taste.
You had a pint of ice cream, but there's some Sun Chips in the closet, and that would be nice to top it off. And then why not open the other ice cream?
I mean, I couldn't turn down a good idea. Something that was making me laugh, that was fresh and different from the stuff we were doing. And if there was a way of doing it, it happened. It wasn't like I sat around making a big decision, talking to people about should I, shouldn't I. It was, we were all laughing. It was a good idea. Here was somebody who said, I'll run with it.
Yes.
They ran with it. You, of course, are involved. But I don't know. So other people are doing heavy work for you.
Yes, you need good writers and showrunners and you must have amazing people. Who was the great person at All in the Family? Who was the genius there one of the big writers you leaned on?
I am. I'm going to speak. I can't remember now whether it's Friday or Saturday, at a memorial for Bob Shiller. So. I loved Bob Shiller, and Shiller and Weisskopf were a team, and they were funny as hell.
Yes.
Do you think time? I've said this often on this podcast. I think laughter adds time to your life.
I hope so.
Don't you think it's possible?
Although I've been thinking lately that as much as I spend most of my life trying to make people laugh, I think I take life too seriously.
Well, I see that in your face as you answer it, but I sure don't see it when you're entertaining. God, you are light on your feet.
But that's the problem. It's the in between where you're taking it too seriously. That's a hard thing.
Yeah, yeah. I you stun me on your feet at Largo and so forth. I just go, how does he do that? How does he do that?
Well, it's a fun to have that outlet because. You know, if I write a movie, it might be years before people see it. So to have an outlet to think of something during the day and then, you know, even like this Harvey Weinstein thing, to go, what do I make of that? How can I talk about it? How can I talk about how disgusted I am but still make people laugh in a way that we feel good about, that we're not acting like this isn't really important, but we could laugh together at the madness of it and hopefully... It's part of what makes us want to change things, and that challenge is really interesting.
The crazy thing, I have not yet been in a conversation or where I've laughed at it, where anybody was funny enough to make me laugh or that I was sufficiently amused to make somebody else laugh.
On that topic,
yes.
I'm going to try right now.
Okay, go.
What is it with everybody?
That's funny.
Even that I tried, made you laugh. What is it with all these people who like to masturbate in front of people? Is it the best part of masturbation that no one's there to judge you?
You know, as somebody who has never in his life masturbated, I don't know how to answer that.
I can't believe you're such a liar. At this point in your life, I thought that maybe you would have learned not to do that.
Would you do me one favor? Explain that to me. Masturbation is what?
Well, here's the thing. There's a sexual urge that people have. Sometimes there aren't people around who care to help you with it, and you deal with it solo.
But I don't understand the urge. You mean you're reading about an urge? And
you use your imagination instead of having another participant.
Uh-huh.
Didn't he do an episode of Maude about this? Wasn't there a Bill Macy masturbation episode? Or
son of a gun. I'd forgotten all about what masturbation is. And we did.
But that's what kept you so young.
God, I remember. God, how old was I? Around 9 or something. Mm-hmm. I remember masturbating before I could achieve an orgasm. Do you remember that
as well. There was a moment like you didn't know how to fully complete the task.
I remember in a bathtub.
Yes.
Making enough noise to have my father. There was a little, what do you call it? A little, it wasn't a major lock. It was a little piece of metal that fit in it. He put his shoulder to the door and broke in.
He was like, Norman, you're clean enough.
And he took me by the ear out of the bathtub and brought me to my mother to apologize.
I'm glad, first of all, that he took you by the ear.
No, but I want you to help me with the psychology here.
Yes. Well, he had to complete the shaming of you. He's like, what would make this more shameful? I will bring him naked to his mother.
Yes, apologize to your mother for what you were doing.
Yes, that'll make you want to have 5 shows on the air. And was your mother shocked, or did she laugh it off?
You know what she did? God, I wonder if I remember correctly. These may not go together. She took me to a doctor. She took me to a doctor.
What kind of doctor?
Some kind of doctor you could talk about masturbating to.
That's a specific kind of child psychologist?
I have no idea. Probably it could have been a urologist.
It must have been a therapist of some kind.
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. But I know we talked about this. I mean, she thought, I guess they didn't know. My father maybe have forgotten it the way I did.
But they were sophisticated people.
No.
No. Were they like from the homeland kind of people?
No, they weren't. But they were not, they were not. My father went to prison when I was 5 years old.
I mean, he was sophisticated enough to be a terrible con man.
Just sophisticated enough to be a terrible comment.
Right? So he should have known about masturbation. If these guys are ripping people off, you got to assume masturbation is part of his day.
He understood it because he took me out of the bathtub. And so forth. I haven't thought about that for 105 years.
Well, this is why you do a Judd Apatow interview, to get Norman Lear to talk about masturbating. What year would that have been?
What year would that have been? That would have been 1931.
Those are like the OG days of masturbating. You were laying down the track. You were inventing it back then.
Yeah, maybe the word came following the act.
Then when your dad got sent to jail, you're like, you gave me a hard time for masturbating?
Yes. It used to be just playing with yourself. What are you doing playing with yourself?
I know. That's the friendliest way to say it.
Yeah.
They never say that in the articles about Harvey Weinstein. He was playing with himself. I got you to laugh about it. Did you see that? I got him to laugh about it. But it's a serious subject.
It couldn't be more serious.
And it's horrible. It made me think about All in the Family and all the episodes you did. You did an episode about rape, which hadn't been done before, and I'm sure you did sexual harassment many times. But I am obviously disgusted with the idea that men victimize women and that women are so traumatized that it's very difficult to come forward. But I can only imagine that in earlier eras, the disrespect must have been just so much worse. Was it?
I think it was pretty much the same and continues. I don't think everything that's going on now is going to do away with what troubles you.
Yes.
The harassment of women. It's been a culture. I think about this. How does the culture serve up the female of the species?
Mm-hmm.
What woman, the female child is born wanting to wear 4-inch heels.
Yes.
You don't put them on for comfort. You put them on for what it does for the look of the leg.
Yes.
And the same thing with the skirt and the chest. What about the chest?
Yes.
How much chest can you reveal? Forget that. What is it all about?
Yeah.
It's the culture, I think, of serving women as sex objects,
yes.
Serving up women as sex objects.
And wasn't that what was so groundbreaking about All in the Family, is you have this man who has this woman who on one level is considered you know, a dingbat, but is actually super smart and incredibly kind and really guiding him and the family. How aware were you of those ideas when you were constructing that family?
I don't know. It was a bunch of us, and we were all aware. But what I'm most aware of right now is I have you, or you have yourself talking about me. Mm-hmm. And you're my fucking guest, and I want to talk about you.
You're so much. Let's be serious. You're so much better than me. So who wants to hear about me? Because all I'm doing is a bad copy of you.
What are you talking about?
So let me just flip it all around. Yeah. But I am fascinated by the era because I know that we're trying to figure out in this business how to respond and how to create an environment where women will feel like they can come forward, and then if they do, we're all here to support them, or young men, because this is happening to men as well. I mean, what do you think just in process could be different about our industry that could help change this?
Well, certainly we could stop writing and directing and shooting women as sex objects.
Yes.
Because I think even in the most serious of films, there's a tendency to favor what basically makes them appealing,
yes,
in a sexual way. Mm-hmm. Not appealing as a human being, but appealing, yeah, sexually.
And a lot of the stories are just getting, the woman is getting a man from A to B and is not the center of the story. A lot of what we've tried to do with Girls and Trainwreck and Bridesmaids is to make movies where they're about women.
Talk about Bridesmaids. Where did, yes, that idea come from? I love that film.
Kristen Wiig, I saw her the first episode of Saturday Night Live that she was on, and I just instantly thought, this is one of the all-time greats. I just had an instinct. I couldn't believe how funny she was on the first episode that she appeared on, because most people are terrified, and they don't really bubble up for sometimes a year or 2 years, and she seemed like she'd been there 10 years from the first episode that she was on. And I asked her to be in Knocked Up. Now, here's the funny thing. I wanted to have a boss for Katherine Heigl. So she works at the E! Network, and she's a entertainment journalist, and I wanted her to have somewhat sexist, awful bosses who want her to stay skinny, and she has a secret. She's pregnant. So we have Alan Tudyk played one of them, and then I thought, it'd be funny if there's two. I'll just have Kristen Wiig play the other. She literally has no lines. We just show up and go, let's follow the script and just chime in. Mm-hmm. Just take some runs. We'll improv for a few hours. And then she just stole the scene and was so hysterical. And then she was in Walk Hard as Dewey Cox's wife, which is a parody of Walk the Line and Ray. And then I said, what do you have? Do you have any ideas? And her friend Annie Mumolo had an idea about a maid of honor whose life was going terribly, and she didn't have any money or a good job or a boyfriend, and what a drag it was to be a maid of honor when all the bridesmaids' lives were better than hers. And then they, worked on that script for several years until it evolved into Bridesmaids.
Oh, my God, that was funny. But Wig, did she in the first show have the hand?
The hand? The tiny hands?
The tiny hands.
There's nothing better than my daughter, when she was really little, used to draw weird stick figure pictures of Kristen with the tiny hands.
Oh, yes?
Yes, they were obsessed with the tiny hands.
Kristen Wiig was Day Before Yesterday to me.
Yes, yeah. Oh, yeah. But so they were great, and it was it was one of those situations where we didn't think we're doing anything for women. Like, during the whole process of making the movie, we never for a moment thought, this is a positive thing to do for our industry or for women, as a way of saying women should star in movies and be the center of comedies. And then when it was done, people said, if this does badly, it'll really be bad for women if it doesn't prove that women want to see movies like this. And then it did really well. And I think it has been part of a very slow change, a change that's not
so it
fast
did very
enough.
Well. So how rich are you?
It's just nuts. Just nuts. I mean, I am now rich enough to afford a quarter of your estate.
But I'm going to tell you in numbers.
Yes.
The shot rings out and he falls. The way I would write this.
But I'm happy that I could just do this work.
Isn't it?
I mean, when I was a kid, the idea that I could be in comedy, that I was such a fan of, Steve Allen and The Tonight Show and Bill Murray and Eddie Murphy, the fact that I'm in the world of comedy baffles me every day. That I was able to sneak in and that I get to make things and collaborate with people and meet my heroes, such as yourself, is always special to me.
A hero of mine, too, was Steve Allen.
Oh, incredible.
God, did I adore Steve Allen.
I interviewed him when I was 16 years old.
Yes.
He had put out a record. I guess when he had the Steve Allen show, they would make phony phone calls with celebrities. And so he would have, like, Jerry Lewis call a deli and say he was planning a party and do this ridiculous debate over what everything would cost. And I went and interviewed him while he was promoting it. And that was how I got into comedy, which is I had a radio show where I would interview comedians. And I interviewed him and Shandling and Leno and Seinfeld. But he was very, very nice. Very nice man.
Who are we talking about?
Well, Steve Allen, but not the others.
Steve Allen, I've been trying to remember his name. He was a great scientist, a media scientist, Canadian.
Marshall?
Yes, McLuhan.
McLuhan, yes.
Marshall McLuhan. I think it was I who introduced Steve Allen and Marshall McLuhan to each other. We had maybe a half a dozen dinners when McLuhan was in town, at which I sat virtually silent, just listening to these two guys, because Steve Allen had a remarkable mind and scholarship, and oh my God, I loved it. And I loved him as the master of ceremonies on his show, as the host.
Yes. He invented a lot of the form. People don't remember that.
Yes.
A lot of what Letterman and Conan do and did came from Steve Allen.
And what's his name? The other guy who was so smart and short.
A short talk show host? A
talk show host. Very literate, very compelling.
Dick Cavett.
Dick Cavett.
Yes.
Yeah.
He doesn't like being known as the short guy.
I'm so sorry I said it. I'm going to call him and ask him not to listen to this.
He was incredible, though.
Oh, he was wonderful.
They show repeats of his show on this network, and I'm always looking for the network, and I can't find it. It's not on my cable system.
You know, somebody told me, was right in this room, Tavis Smiley. We did a podcast. It was his podcast. Yes. I was his guest. But he watches Maude every evening at 9 o'clock.
Wow.
On some family something. Family is in the title of the of the network.
And how much are you getting on each airing?
Zip.
Oh, my God. It just gets lower and lower till it's nothing.
Zip, zip, zip. We sold the library to Sony.
There you go.
And we talk all the time about it. I've been an ambassador for a lot of years for that library.
That's right.
And it isn't like that library doesn't turn up, as Tavis Smiley assured me.
You sold it too early.
Yeah, I think so.
You never think anyone is going to want to see these things, and then they hold their value. Out of the blue, the world.
Have you made the same mistake with some of your things?
I don't own anything, so I don't have that.
Those films you don't own, Funny or Die?
I'm a participant in Funny or Die. But for the most part, no, I don't really own anything, so I don't have that issue.
Yeah.
But I'm sure it all worked out for you. You've always been good with money, huh?
No. My wife is much better than I am.
Have you ever gone bankrupt?
Yeah. Not bankrupt,
close
but
to
broke.
It.
But broke.
In what era?
In the era just before this one.
Yeah. And what pulled you out? Like what happened?
I had a great partner, Jerry Parencio, and he made a business of. He was the guy responsible for those of us who wrote and produced early comedy to own it. You know, at the beginning, the network owned everything.
So you started your own company to own all those shows.
Well, even with your own company, you didn't. We had to fight the battle.
Yes.
To start to own those shows. And he was uh, He passed just a couple of months ago. When you get to this age, you see a lot of, you use the word much more often than you'd wish to. Past.
Yes. Exactly. It must be a terrible feeling.
It ain't a good one.
Yeah.
It ain't a good one.
That's why you're refreshing with newer friends like me.
Yes.
You got to get a. You got to just like refresh the computer, get a whole new run.
Yes, but you're turning 50, so you're out soon.
I'm not as healthy as Jerry was. So you got about 18 months left on me.
Uh-huh.
You need like some 25-year-olds.
When you said Jerry that time, I thought you were talking about Jerry Lewis.
Yes.
Did you know Jerry at all?
I did not know Jerry Lewis, but I'll tell you a funny story, which is I was working at Comic Relief, which was a benefit for the homeless, and this is 1986. I'm 19 years old. My job is to get every celebrity to sign the poster so they can sell it for charity. So I'm following around Jerry Lewis trying to get him to sign the poster. He's walking over to this area where all the photographers are going to take pictures of him. So there's about 20 photographers following him as he's walking to the photo area. And as they're all running over there, one guy falls really hard and just falls. And he jumps back up. And then Jerry Lewis turns to him and goes, "You're supposed to fall, wait for the laugh, then get up." And that was my one Jerry Lewis moment. But you wrote a lot of the great Jerry Lewis television material in his sketch show.
Simmons and I wrote the first 3 years of the Colgate Colgate Comedy Hour.
And what was that like to write a bit, hand it to Jerry Lewis, and have him just crush it?
First show. First Colgate Comedy Hour. After the show, I'm sitting. David Susskind was my agent. I'm sitting with David Susskind and his wife, and I'm crying, literally crying, because we had written a couple of sketches, but there was the first sketch of the first show. The motion picture industry was concerned about television. This was in the earliest days. And so they had a big promotion. Movies are better than ever. Every movie theater in the country had that sign. Movies are better than ever, as a promotion to halt the march of television,
which did not work at all.
No. So, but this was the opening sketch. Dean was the manager of a motion picture theater. Marilyn Maxwell, who was a hot singer at the time, was the guest on the show. She was in the box office. And it was the front of the theater. There was nobody in the theater. And Dean is bawling her out for how come you can't sell a ticket or something. Jerry comes along bouncing a ball. He's a young kid bouncing a ball. And Dean wants him to buy a ticket. So the whole thing is Dean is finally hitting him with a balloon. Yeah. Carrying. And they finally get Jerry into the theater. And within a minute, he screams and comes rushing out. His place is empty, and it's dark, and he's scared to death. So that was our comment on movies are better than ever, the whole schemata. And Jerry. He was hilarious, and the whole thing became how funny Jerry was. I was crying because we didn't make... Even then, there was something to say, and it was lost because Jerry was clowning so much.
Oh, I see.
That's what bothered me. And Susskind was saying, you're out of your mind. Monday morning, they're going to be, you know, they own the country. You're out. Not interested in what I was.
Yes.
But just that it the audience went crazy. And
not interested in your satire.
And not at all. All that took place. 2 weeks later, the motion picture industry, I'm trying to remember the name of their manager. I always remember it. Invade on him and them and whoever, MCA at the time. And they took out an ad apologizing for that sketch. So
who took out the ad? Jerry Lewis?
They did.
Lewis and Martin said, sorry, we made fun of you.
Sorry, yes. They took out an ad apologizing for that. And but I told the story because from the very beginning, the idea behind what we were trying to do was paramount.
And you were trying to sneak in all sorts of different ideas into these silly sketches.
So we are running out of we've run out of time. If I'm reading faces behind that mirror, behind that
I have nowhere to go, Norman. This is what you don't understand about me.
So we'll do another few hours.
I have literally nothing to do. I could take up all podcast digital space right now due to my lack of an evening
well,
activity.
Let me ask the people who are listening, would you like us just to continue for a couple of days here?
Yeah.
We could eat in. And,
sure.
Yeah.
We didn't even get to good times.
But the Jeffersons or Funny or Die.
Jimmy Walker sent me the other day a photo of him and Eddie Vedder from Pearl Jam and somebody else because he was at the tribute to David Letterman.
Oh, yes.
And he sent pictures of him with all the different stars who paid tribute to Letterman at the Mark Twain Awards at the Kennedy Center. And he was very excited.
I've sat at the same table with him at two award ceremonies.
Jimmy Walker.
Yeah. And guess, you wouldn't guess in 100 years who his dinner partner was, who his date was.
His date, Monica Lewinsky.
No. It's even better than that. That's good. That's good.
Anita Hill. Who was it?
Ann Coulter.
Wow. That's troubling. I would assume...
Ann Coulter. This is two dinners a couple of years apart.
Yes. Ann Coulter I met once at the Comedy Cellar in New York, and I thought, this is probably a shtick. She doesn't mean all this stuff she says. She's just doing it to make money and making a strong choice to sell some books. And I talked to her for 5 minutes, and everything that she says, she means it and more, and it's even more hateful in person. It was deeply troubling.
It is deeply troubling.
And you know what it wasn't? Dynamite. It was not dynamite.
Go explain. Maybe, Jimmy, if you're hearing this, and maybe I'll call you and ask you to come and do this podcast.
That would be fantastic. I'd love to hear that.
I'd like to do that. So we shall do that. I have to say goodbye because they're all waving me off.
I understand.
So.
How did it go? Did it go well? Did it go well?
Huh?
Did it go well?
Yes, they indicate thumbs up.
Okay, good.
Thumbs up. So I am looking across the table at a grown man. I am a grown man and love the other grown man and don't give a shit who knows it.
I love you as
And to be continued, this is Norman Lear, and this has been All of the Above.
What does it mean, this life, this day and night?
So I'm Norman Lear, and you can find me, should you wish to hunt me down, you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at The Norman Lear.
And you can find me on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at Paul Diff.
And life is good, and space and time. Give me some of yours, I'll give you some of mine.
It's the Lady Gang podcast, and we're very excited because Jenna Fisher, you know her, Pam from The Office, is on our show, and she's talking about her brand new book, An Actor's Life. She's also talking about the time she auditioned with Larry David and hugged him when he was trying to get her to leave the room. It's amazing.
I've never been so jealous.
It's one of the funniest episodes and funniest guests we've ever had on, so tune in to the Lady Gang this Tuesday, exclusively at PodcastOne.com or the new Podcast One app, and don't forget to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts so we can feel famous.